transmitiendo desde Frankfurt, en Alemania, al margen de la Feria Internacional del Libro de Frankfurt. Esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía y derecho con un carácter totalmente informal. And today we have a very special program here from Frankfurt and Maine, and we have the pleasure of talking with Professor Gunther Theuner. Professor Theuner, it's a pleasure to be with you today.
My pleasure.
And you are one of the most prestigious scholars that work with the idea of Niklas Luhmann. Mm-hmm. For some legal students and legal scholars, they don't believe that the system that Niklas Luhmann proposed is efficient to study law. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think the most important idea of Luhmann is not just the idea of the system. Rather, it is the separation or even alienation of society against consciousness, of social communication against psychic processes. So I think this is his major contribution, that we do not think of a unity of meaning created by intersubjectivity, by us people talking, rather that there are two different separate meaning processes. Meaning is created once in individual thought and feelings, and on the other side in our social communication, social system. So that's the very point. The distinction between these two spheres, and that each of them has a life of their own and is an independent process of creation of meaning. So it's not just the idea that there are social systems closed or something. Rather, it's the idea that there are two living meaning processes that are interdependent but separate. And this, I think, explains very well many of the so-called collective phenomena we are talking about. For example, the legal person, but also the law as a kind of independent discourse, independent from the consciousness of the jurists, and so on and so on. So I think this is the fruitful idea, and people tend to see when they make this criticism about systems, they tend only to look at social systems and not to see that Luhmann's theory is broader. It is the interrelation between social systems and psychic internal consciousness processes. That's the important idea.
In your book, where you talk about the law as an autopoietic system, you also talk about Habermas' theory.
Uh-huh.
And once you talk about the meaning and the different meanings that a system can have, what is the relation of the theory of Luhmann and the theory of Habermas on your thinking?
Yeah, well, it has to do with this very question. I think Habermas thinks too closely in terms of intersubjectivity, putting together consciousness and communication. So he cannot really grasp the special meaning of what collective phenomena are. So he thinks much too much in terms of only that you and me, we are actors. And he cannot really grasp the own dynamics of non-personal processes, collective processes. And I think this is an old idea, which has been always present in Hegel's thought, for example. But it has never been as... or shall I say, lucidly exposed as by Niklas Luhmann, that we have to understand the independence of collective phenomena. So neither Habermas nor the whole American philosophy and economics thinking of methodological individualism is able to grasp the social and phenomenal reality of collective processes.
But you thought that also the law is an epistemic subject.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean with the epistemic subject?
Yeah, again, you know, the tradition, the philosophical tradition, thought that the epistemic subject is consciousness, human consciousness in different variation, for example, transcendental consciousness or empirical consciousness, but it was always related to the single individual being. So this tradition has no idea about cognition on a collective basis. So it was only language philosophy which started to think about language as an epistemic phenomenon, as an epistemic subject of its own. But the language philosophy forgot about the subject, about the individual. They have no place for the individual. Well, then Luhmann made this move of arguing that we have to deal with two different processes of creation of meaning. So an epistemic object is you and me and him and us, so as individuals in our thoughts. But at the same time, language, communication, and then special systems of communication like the law or the economy are epistemic subjects of their own, which create a construction of their own world. And that's the important thing, that we have to see there is not one world in which we live all together. Rather, there are several parallel universes of world creation. And the law creates one world of its own, the legal person with its obligation and duties and rights and guilt and all that, like the Kafka world, as opposed to the economic world, which creates this world of utility maximization, and so on. So each of these social spheres creates a reality of its own. And this is the world we are living in. And therefore, all these social systems are epistemic subjects of their own.
That's why you tend to talk about globalization and pluralism.
Among other things, yes. I mean, pluralism has different meanings. One meaning is legal pluralism. One meaning is the epistemological pluralism I was just talking about. Epistemological pluralism would see there is not one subject of cognition in this world. Rather, there are different, a plurality of them. Some of them are individuals like you and me. Some are those parallel universes in the social world. So this would be the pluralism of different epistemic worlds. While legal pluralism would, with globalization now, would refer to a different phenomenon. It would refer to, legal pluralism, we had this in the medieval time, we had this in the colonial time, when the colonial occupiers had their law imposing on the indigenous law, and then they had this legal pluralism. And we have the legal pluralism of Eugen Ehrlich. But globalization creates a new type of legal pluralism, which is, example would be the lex sportiva, the lex digitalis, the lex mercatoria. It would be the legal system of multinational enterprises. So we do not have any longer only the dualism of national law and international law. Rather, we have a plurality of legal orders, some of them national, some of them ethnic and religious, but some of them global. And there I'm referring to those different global regimes which create legal orders of their own.
In this kind of world, how do we know the norm then?
How do we know the norm? In the worst case, we have to go to different tribunals, either national courts, international courts, or arbitration tribunals. And if there is a legal dispute and the norm is in question, this kind of tribunal would then decide which of the norm is valid in which area of jurisdiction. either in a nation state or in one of those regimes or in the Lex Mercatoria or in transnational enterprise. So there are, if you want, authorities of positive law, as we know from the nation state or the national courts, also in different areas in the world, which decides about the identity of a legal norm in a given jurisdiction.
Yeah, the question is directed by an essay you wrote in the Hans Wetzel Homenage that was named Known the Norm and Unknown the Norm. And what did interest me about it is when you say, well, the norm has to be known by society. It's a condition that the norm be known by society.
Uh-huh.
If the society doesn't know the norm because it's very different, they have many ethnic races,
yes,
or many,
yes,
immigrants,
yeah,
then what happens with the law?
Well, the law is no longer a coherent unity of norms that are systematically interrelated and that obey the famous hierarchy of rules, as Kelsen formulated, from the smallest rules to the statutory norms, to the constitutional norms, to international law, to the Grundnorm, right? So this picture has to be replaced by a plurality of legal orders without hierarchy, rather on a heterarchical basis. So we are living in a world with contradicting rules, valid rules. So take, for example, the famous case Yahoo, France against Yahoo. So there was Nazi material which was put on the internet, and this was forbidden according to French law. So after a complaint, the courts decided this is forbidden, has to be deleted from the internet. And then Yahoo went to an American court, and what did they say? No, just the opposite. Freedom of opinion, this can be there. So this kind of contradictions of valid, positive legal rules, in this case between France and the United States on the internet, which is a global institution, is a good example for the existence of contradicting rules in the global world. So this is our situation, and we cannot just try to argue, hey, the law has to be a coherent hierarchical unit.
And this means also that it's irrational, the law is irrational in these kind of systems?
Yeah, I mean, I have doubts about the rationality of law in any case, even in a kind of coherent hierarchical order. But yeah, in this sense, you can call it irrational because there is the famous saying by Pascal, what ridiculous justice. On the one side of the Pyrenees, there's one legal rule, and on the other side of the Pyrenees, the opposite. Right? So in this sense, it's irrational. But of course, at the same time, legal rules are expressions of a certain rationality, be it the famous formal legal rationality of Max Weber, or the rationalities of judge-made law, or be it the rationality of economic action, of political action. So it's not a total irrationality. Rather, it is the coexistence of partial rationalities which are expressed in contradicting legal norms, which do not find their unity in a kind of overarching norm. That's the situation we're living with. This is pluralism in a deeper sense than one usually talks about it.
And in this way, you also talk about the legal autopoiesis.
Mm-hmm.
What's the meaning of legal autopoiesis?
Well, the meaning of legal autopoiesis is that we have to look at law as a self-reproducing entity. But it's not a kind of holistic concept. Rather, it is a concept that starts with the self-reproduction of singular legal acts. So the element, the basic element of an autopoietic system is a singular legal act, like the judge judging, or the legislation, or the contract, right? And these legal acts are producing legal rules, and the legal rules in turn again legal acts. So this interrelation between norm, rule, norm, act is the way in which the law reproduces itself, right? And this is autopoiesis, no? That the self-reproduction of identical elements via structures. And the idea about this autopoiesis is the closure, which I think is the most contested idea, especially legal philosophers and legal sociologists say this cannot be. Law is not closed, rather it is exposed to all kinds of social influences. I do not contest that. Rather, that there is a special closure of law, not like it, like in a container where nothing can go into it, rather. But at the same time, it's not a kind of open transfer of information from the outside into the law. Rather, it is the irritation of a circular process of legal act, norm, which is then, in a sense, irritated by social facts, by complaints, and by all that. So there's a lot of causal influences on the law. But the important point, the closure, is this self-reproductive circle of act, rule, which is at the center.
In Mexico, most of the legal scholars still follow most of Kelsen's ideas.
Kelsen.
And they believe that politics must be outside of the legal system. Still, one of the rules you told us about the autopoietics legal system is that it's highly politicized.
Well, I mean, there is a kind of common starting point, Kelsen and Luhmann, which is the idea of a legal system. Kelsen speaks about norms as elements. Luhmann speaks about acts as elements. This is an important difference. But there's also certain closure, and there is a certain distance from politics. So you have to distinguish legal rules, the pure theory of law, the hierarchy of law, from the political decisions. And then Luhmann, you have to distinguish between the interrelation between legal acts and legal rules and politics. But now the interesting differences appear. In system theory, you have to think of a double politicization of the law. One is the influence of the institutionalized political process, parliament and government and all that, which has an influence on law, but only in the sense of an external irritation of internal processes, which needs then to be a reconstruction in which is not a direct translation of one to the other. So it's a only indirect politicization of law. And the second one is perhaps even more interesting, which is the internal politics of law. That within the legal autopoiesis, within this self-reproductive process of norms, rules, and principles and acts, there is an autonomous legal process of, let's call it politics. I prefer to speak about reflection processes, because a legal autopoiesis is not an automatic machinery, where from acts follow rules and from rules follow acts. Rather, there is the famous hiatus, the gap between a legal act creates a possibility of different expectations, and they again create a possibility of different new legal acts. So there is a hiatus, a gap between structures and acts, norms and legal acts, right? And this is the place where legal reflection comes in, or the politics within the law comes in. Lawyers call this sometimes discretion, or they say this is Carl Schmitt's decisionism situation, right? In Habermas, it is also there. If you think about the rational discourse, which produces arguments, but is it true that the arguments then create really the result, or is it not the consensus that follows those arguments which then creates the result? So I think in this dark concept of consensus, there is the kind of political element included which I'm talking about.
Yes, because sometimes you talk about the collision of discourses.
Okay. Again, this is again a different question. I mean, we have the collision of discourses already in the interrelation between the legal process and official politics. So legislative and government policies as against the courts and their decision-making. This is a collision of discourses, but of course this is not the only one. You have the collision between law and the economy, law and culture, law and the health process, and so on, right? And these are probably the followers of Karl Marx's structural conflicts within society. When Marx speaks about the internal contradictions within the economy, that are then creating the superstructure, the class structure, and the political fight and the legal system. In a similar way, it is the structural social conflicts between different rationalities and different social systems that lies at the bottom of social conflict, of many social conflicts, let's say, and then legal structures that emerge to deal with them.
What happened when the legal discourses or the legal positions in a legal system goes beyond the conflict and become a paradox? What is one of the main areas you study?
Yes, this is one of the intriguing situation where you do not just talk about contradictions and conflicts and antagonisms, but rather when you talk about paradoxes, which is close to a contradiction, but which is different, because a paradox has this strange circular structure that once you say A, you end up with non-A, and once you say non-A, you end up with A, right? So it's a very intricate, contradictory but circular structure as well, which creates big confusion. And how does this enter in such a crystalline formalistic theory like system theory of law, right? Very strange, huh? It's a theory of order, is it not? And it's the place of paradoxes. But there's a very strict line of thought between the two, because once you acknowledge self-production, autopoiesis, and self-reference, you inevitably run into paradoxes. Like the famous Cretan liar who says, I'm a Crete and I'm lying. And then you do not know, is he lying or not, and all that. So this is similar in law. The self-reference directly leads into a paradoxical situation, which then opens chaos, confusion, paralysis. Right? So this theory combines in a very strange way elements of high order, system theory, element structures and all that, as opposed to situations of disorder, chaos, confusion, paralysis. And these things interrelate. Any legal order is always threatened by its paradox all the time. And when historical situation change, the paradox reappears and tends to subvert the wonderful legal order. So globalization, for example, was one of the situations where the paradox of law suddenly reemerged. So take the case of the Lex Mercatoria. Where's the legitimation of Lex Mercatoria? Nowhere. It's just a private law out of the air without any support by state contract law and all that. So it's contract without law. And it is exposed to the paradox of self-reference of contract. What is the basis, the fundamental basis of contract? Is it contract itself? And so on and so on. So here we have the paradox, which then is reappearing because the nation state cannot cover this paradox anymore. And it is now up to the actors on the transnational scene to deal with this paradox. And how do they do this? They do this, for example, via externalization. They create legal institutions of their own, the arbitration courts, a kind of legislative institutions and all that, which then, in a sense, begin to cover the paradoxical situation of this new law. So in this sense, transnational law repeats the paradoxical situation that the nation state has with its own constitution, when the pouvoir constituant is constituting itself, although it doesn't exist, but at the same time it has to exist. No? There was this paradox there. And the same paradox reappears now in the transnational sphere, of course, under different circumstances. And I think this makes the whole situation so dynamic, and if you want, also creative. Huh? So we see there are, in the transnational scene, processes of new law production that even start with the constitutional rules, and not just the creation of some legal norms.
To understand the paradoxes, you also use the deconstruction of Derrida, and you use it also on Luhmann, the deconstruction.
Yes.
How should we understand the construction?
Yes. I mean, this is a somewhat improbable combination, right?
Yes.
So people say, what? Now, deconstruction and system theory, they are like this. But in my view, there are secret connections, which Luhmann has seen, because he was citing Derrida quite some time. But Derrida did not care about Luhmann. No, this was system theory, which he was not concerned about. But the interesting thing, it's especially the paradoxical question which unites these two theories. Well, there's more to it. I mean, if you think of Derrida's concept like iteration or difference, which is a kind of continual creation and destruction of differences in a kind of historical process, this is very, very close to autopoiesis, very close. The self-reproduction of differences in a social process. But there's more to it, and especially that both of them see at the bottom of the law the non-foundational foundations. Both say there is no Grundnorm, or there is no natural law norm or anything that could be the foundation of law. Rather, it is violence, paradox, in Luhmann's case, self-reference, but even in Derrida's case, he talks about the self-reference of law. So there, that's what unites them, this common interest in the paradox at the bottom of the law. But then they go into different directions, and then I tend even to follow Derrida more than Luhmann, because when Luhmann becomes aware of a paradox, he says, stop it, evade it, go away. Create a new distinction which covers the paradox, and then we can go with our legal process. Well, Derrida says, no, expose yourself to the paradox. Go through it. Have the experience that, at the bottom of law is chaos, wildness, confusion, which is a provocation, for thought and action, right? And I think this is a very good idea that at the bottom of law there is this chaotic, paradoxical relation which is a provocation for, and now comes the interesting concept, for justice, right? So there, this interrelation between self-reference, paradox, and justice, I think this is where Derrida goes beyond Luhmann and where I would like to follow Derrida's ideas.
There is one of the essays also you wrote is about the new theories on the modern law system. And you tell us in that essay that there are two main streams we can follow. One in the United States, following the works of Nonetta and Selznick, and the other one following Habermas and Luhmann.
Mm-hmm.
What is the importance of Nonetta and Selznick in the United States?
Well, I think Nonet and Selznick are important as bridges between European traditions of legal theory and legal philosophy and American ones. That's where their historical merit lies. And so, for example, they took up from Durkheim the idea of different phases of law that follow different social structures, the famous mechanic solidarity and organic solidarity that reappears in their theory as three steps of law, what they call the repressive law, the autonomous law, and the responsive law. All right, and I think this is a very important development of Durkheim's idea, especially then the question when they go beyond Durkheim in with the idea of responsive law. So I think there they have very important merits, which I think makes it fruitful to have an encounter of this type of American theories, Selznick and Nonet, and the Habermasian and Luhmannian strand. So there are enough convergences, but at the same time differences, which are worthwhile to be pursued.
Also, going through these two lines, it made me question one aspect. Does the law has limits, the rationality of law has limits, or is unlimited?
Oh, it has very, very narrow limits, I would say. Very early you arrive at the limits of law, in several senses. I mean, you know, I'm really opposed against this kind of panjurism, which you find in some constitutional lawyers who think they are the kind of new architects of society. I think the contribution of law to society is in itself very, very limited. And we should not see law at the top or something. Rather, it is, you know, almost marginal, in an angle of society, which in a sense has to deal with economic dynamics and political dynamics and the legal dynamics. Yeah, they are there, but they are limited. So this is one limit of law. And the other limit of law is, yeah, the relation of positive law and justice. So very, very soon positive law finds its limits with the usual processes of application of law and interpretation, and it does not reach justice. And so this is then the important thing, that positive law is so narrowly limited that it takes a great leap in order to arrive at something we would call justice.
Analytical legal systems doesn't help at all in this kind of...
Well, that's too much. I do not argue for a kind of free law, as the Freirecht, as the Germans call it, so that the only thing is the sense of justice which leads you to... I think analytical jurisprudence and the kind of dogmatics, you know, we are dealing with in positive law are very, very important, because they pre-structure the situation. They translate an unresolvable social conflict into a different legal conflict, which has quite different contours than the social conflict. So once we reformulate a social conflict in our dogmatic constructions, I mean, people say, what are you talking about, right? But at the same time, this is important. This is important because it helps to move conflicts out of these spheres and opens new avenues for new solutions. But it is not able to decide cases. It only reformulates or translates social conflict into legal ones and confronts us with a new situation of decision. It's different from the social, where the two parties are conflicting and want to kill each other or something. But in law, it becomes a conflict of different legal principles, rules, and all that. But still, it remains a conflict, and decision has to be taken. And this is then the point where, you know, what I would call the irrational, but not bad, the irrational elements come in, right? Considerations of justice, legal emotions, even sense of art, sense of equilibrium, and all that, where they are then moving the decision beyond our analytical categories that we develop in legal doctrine.
One of the latest theories you have been working is about the hypercyclical changes. What is the hypercyclical changes for the people that is listening to us?
Yes. Well, I would prefer to speak about two things, hypercycle and ultracycle. And they have to do with the process of law becoming autonomous as against social processes. So in different societies you have a kind of cosmological unity of law, religion, economic aspect, political aspects, and all that. And law is just part of it, so that you cannot really separate it from other things. And then begins a certain process of gradual autonomization of law, which leads to the emergence of legal acts and legal rules, still dependent on social processes and all that. And then the hypercycle comes in as an autonomous interrelation between, as I said in the beginning of the interview, between acts, legal acts and rules, and together with legal doctrine and legal procedure. And these four elements create a kind of circular autonomy that distinguishes autonomous law from other fields of society, right? But now the ultracycle, and this is the hypercycle, because this is a concept, an analogy to biology. The hypercycle was an idea. How is it possible that circular processes in biology can take place? And there it's not enough to identify a cyclical process, because the cyclical process need to be fed by other processes, which are then called the hypercycle. And this is similar in law, where then this hypercyclical relations are supporting the cyclical relations within law. Now, what one loses in this emergence of the hypercycle is the direct contract to society, to politics, to morality, to the economy, and so on. And here the ultracycle comes in again as an analogy to biological processes, where biologists try to define the interrelation between autonomous circular biological processes, right? So against the hypercycle, which takes place inside an autonomous system, the ultracycle takes place outside or in between different autonomous systems. So here we have the question now, how under the conditions of high autonomy are the interrelations between the economy and law, politics and law, culture and law, and so on? And here the important thing is to see that these are not direct transfers of information. Rather, we have to speak about something that I call perturbation cycle. Like in the game of Chinese whispers. Do you know Chinese whispers?
Yes. Oh,
well, you have the circle of people and they start with one concept and goes through the different heads, and they add something totally different comes out, right?
Yes.
So this kind of productive misunderstanding, this is the idea of the ultra cycle, that the different social systems influence each other very strongly, but only via productive misunderstandings, because each statement in one language is then reconstructed in the different language, so it gets transformed. And here I see a moment of productivity, of creativity, which people do not see if they just speak of intersubjectivity. So it's a productivity of the productive misunderstanding. And an example would be, standardization. When you speak about environmental problems, and here are the natural scientists that tell us, here we have a curve and the damage becomes greater and greater, right? But where's the limit? Where's the point where we should say legal, illegal? Huh? So they cannot decide on that. They only give this kind of information to the law, which is an irritation for the law, and the law then reconstructs this whole thing and creates via its own conceptual means the famous limit between this kind of ecological damage is still legal and here it becomes illegal. So this is a decision which natural science cannot do, but only either politics or law. And then this thing goes again to politics or the economy, and there are always these kind of perturbations between the different parallel universes that it's not real communication like between you and me, right? It's more, disturbance, noise or something, but which then creates interesting results, and which even creates the possibility of coexistence, of living together.
It's hard then to talk about certainty in law.
What? Hard?
Certainty?
Yeah, it's terrible. Certainty doesn't exist at all. It doesn't exist. I mean, the uncertainty is high, super high, right? It is reduced to a certain degree by what we call dogmatics, Argumentation, interpretation, this narrows down the answer.
But it still is a fiction.
No, it's not. You are too anarchic for my we should not denigrate the role of norms, their interpretation, legal argumentation, and all that, because this is reducing the total uncertainty to a, shall I call it, a structured uncertainty, right, which produces not just total arbitrariness, rather, which produces structured situation for the decision to be made. And there is then the uncertainty, right, which is high, which is very high, and which we cannot finally reduce via interpretation, argumentation, norm setting, and definitions, whatever, right? It's not possible. So there is the inevitable uncertainty, which has some resemblance to your anarchic chaos. But there's a difference. So we're talking about structured uncertainty.
You're in your university, you are working with a group of students and scholars doing new theories or try to work on new theories. Can you tell us about that group? Because this is quite interesting.
Yes. I mean, there are different things. One is the group of, let's say, my group within the universities with my assistants and people. We're very close together, and we are working on this theory I'm talking about, especially in private law. But then there is the other thing, which is this cluster in Frankfurt, the normativity, the emergence of normativity, which is much broader, which is a group of 150 people, many of them Habermasians, a tiny minority, the Luhmann type. And, the common theme is, what can we say about normative phenomena, especially in the globalized world? So this is the great theme, where philosophers, economists, political scientists, and lawyers are working not too close in the sense of a collective project, rather in a combination and very dense interaction of individual projects, right? And here I fit in with my project on transnational constitutionalism. So not only the emergence of new legal rules in the transnational world, like in the Lex Mercatoria, rather more special, the question of whether constitutive rules or even constitutional rules emerge outside the nation state. Because we tend to say it is the nation state where the constitution phenomenon is strictly coupled. That's the place for the constitution. And outside the nation state, there are no constitutions. But I follow this line that, and this group also follow this line, that we can identify empirically the emergence of constitutional rules beyond the nation state in things like the United Nations or the WTO, that are international organizations, regimes that create their own constitutional rules. And at the same time, more interesting, especially for me as a private lawyer, than the rules in private ordering. My thesis is that we do not only identify primary rules of private ordering, rather constitutional rules of private ordering. And here lies the great provocation for us. Here lies the challenge for us to identify these constitutional sites and to see what the main rule of constitutions today is, which is limiting the, how shall I say, the unleashed dynamics, not only like traditional constitutional theory does of politics, that power needs to be limited. That's the old thing, which is still all right and important. Look at NSE. But even more important today is to limit, to put limits on the unleashed dynamics of the economy, in the internet, of the medical process, of technology. So if you think of Fukushima, this is a constitutional problem, Fukushima, that it's not just capitalism, and you know the profit motive of the firms that pushes nuclear industry. It's at the same time a kind of unleashed energies of the technological scientific process that leads to more and more and more inventions and pushes us into disastrous situations. I mean, look at Fukushima, how that goes on. So I think that the limitation of technological processes like Fukushima is a constitutional promise, not for the state, but for the economy and for the technology. And this is a new theme. Constitutional limitative rules, not only in the state sphere, rather in the sphere of the economy, of also the media, if you want. Look at the internet and look at Google and all these processes and technology, also medicine. I mean, my wonderful melancholy is called today depression, and it's treated with Prozac and all this stuff. I don't want that, right? Yes. I want the limitation of this medicalization of our life. And these are constitutional rules against the expansionist tendencies of terrible autopoietic systems.
But that's quite a problem, because the law moves too slow and the technology moves too fast, isn't it?
Yes. The famous legal lag, the lag of the legal system is there. Although I must say the law has sped up. I mean, legislative processes are quite fast, and also court decision making is not as slow. And so if you think at protests of NGOs against certain developments in the finance industry or in the ecological area or in the technology, very soon they raise not only political issues but legal issues, right? Human rights. So I wouldn't say it's totally slow and ineffective. Rather, I can see that. Perhaps I should add that. In my view, constitutions are not just legal processes or legal documents or legal rules. In my view, constitutions are interconnections between, let's take the state constitution, between the legal constitutional rules, the hierarchy and the constitutional courts, and political processes. So both of them form the constitution. This is what I call double reflexivity. So a constitution is the self-constituting of politics. Power constitutes power and limits power,
yes.
Right? And then the law comes in, also as reflexive and secondary norms and constitutional rules, and in this way. So it's only the cooperation of legal and political processes that creates a constitution, and the same with the economic constitution. So it's not just the rules on the economy. Rather, it is economic processes in their self-constitution, but also self-limitation. Think of the rules of the role of central banks, that via monetary processes reflexively steer the economy, either expanding or shrinking, right? And at the same time, together with combined legal norms. Also, the internet is a good example.
Yes.
We cannot understand the constitution of the internet if we just think of legal rules, human rights and competence rules. Rather, it's the code, Lessig's code, the digital structure of the internet in its reflexive mode. So not any digital structure, rather those that steer the internet, right? And they, together with legal rules, form the constitution of the internet.
What new words can we expect from you in the near future?
Well, I think I will go on between the interrelation between, in economic terms, economic constitution and economic democracy. So are constitutions limited to creating the constitutive sphere of the economy, to create market structure, to create the rule of law within within the economy, or are constitutions also gearing toward something we would call democratizing social processes and economic processes? And here I'm interested in this question. You know, it's not new in a sense, because already Sinsheimer started with this idea of labor democracy, the participation of workers and labor unions, and this was then continued in co-determination and all this idea about economic democracy. And today we have this debate on corporate social responsibility, which is not only the limitation of corporations, but also the question of to what degree does it introduce new participation rights. Then I would like to look especially again at the internet, so at the collusion between NSA and Google and Facebook, and you know, the creation of spaces of freedom within the internet from below, that the hacker scene invents new technologies of, what is it called, decoding, so creates spaces of closure within the internet that even the NSA could not interfere with. This for me would be a democratic creation of a space of constitutional rights within the internet. So I think that's the only hope we have in this process. Because, I mean, government, even parliaments, political parties, they are so much involved into this NSA business, right? So they are colluding with them. And, of course, there is this international competition which makes political systems almost impotent in protecting human rights. Because they compete against each other, you know, who is better in creating the better spyware and the better interference systems. So where are the counterpowers that would create constitutional rights against this collusion of NSA and the private firms like Google and all this? And I see only two or three, which is the protest movements, the professions, and the courts. Right? Where else?
That sounds very interesting. Professor Turner, it has been a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. Pleasure's on my side.
That you receive us in your house to do this interview.
Right? Thank you. Look inside your soul.